I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to have what promises to be a lively conversation with one of the most provocative political and public policy writers and observers around, Thomas Frank. Frank is the author of, among other works, What's the Matter with Kansas, The Wrecking Crew, Pity the Billionaire, and most recently, Listen Liberal. We'll talk with Frank about the state of the nation in Donald Trump's America. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. Got a special show today. We're going to be talking with the author, Thomas Frank. He is one of the liveliest political writers and observers in the United States these days. He is the author of, among other books, What's the Matter with Kansas, The Wrecking Crew, Pity the Billionaire, Listen Liberal, and has been a columnist for both Harper's Magazine and the Wall Street Journal. Thomas, welcome to the program.
John, it's great to be here in Indianapolis.
It's good to have you here, and I should invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Tom, what brings you to Indianapolis?
Well, John.
Okay, we're doing dueling radio voices here, I guess. Okay.
I'm Listen Liberal has my book about what's wrong with the Democratic Party has come out in paperback, and in order to sort of introduce it to the world, I am going to cities in the various Midwestern states that Donald Trump won. You know, the Indiana is that everyone knew he was going to win.
Yeah.
Indiana. This is not a big surprise,
yeah.
But I'm going all over the place in Pennsylvania, Ohio. I meant to go to Michigan, but now it looks like that's not going to happen. But Iowa, Missouri, also Minnesota, Illinois, Wisconsin.
Okay. And are you traveling as part of the book tour, or are you doing
reporting
here? Oh, yeah.
That's what this is. And you know, I'm from Kansas City, which
yeah.
is very similar. I mean, Kansas and Indiana have a kind of kinship that nobody knows. They, you know, my joke is that Indiana is a kind of vertical Kansas. but Indianapolis, I mean, looks a lot like visually looks like Kansas City. So I feel driving down the street here, it's hard to remember that I'm not, you know, driving around in Kansas City.
And you're going to be speaking tonight, right?
That's right. I'm going to be out at the Steelworkers Hall, which is at 218 South Addison Street, I think tonight. I think it's 7 o'clock. I'm going to be talking about Listen Liberal and what has gone wrong with the Democratic Party. I mean, among other things, how they managed to lose this last election.
And I want to talk about we can start with Listen Liberal. I mean, I actually have kind of a questioning strategy that begins with what's the matter with Kansas,
yes,
too.
You
but
do however you want to
but
do it.
But no, it's more organic if we go this way. So this book really, as you pointed out, is I'm trying to think of another word, but savage comes to mind. Pretty
so?
Savage.
Well,
I think it's actually unsparing. Unsparing
yeah.
is a better
yeah.
is a better word to describe unsparing critique of the Democratic
well,
Party.
Well, they, you know, they need it.
And liberalism, too,
yeah.
in general.
I am a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm even a registered Democrat, and I voted for Hillary Clinton. But these, you know, I've written three books about conservatism,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to understand the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And, you know, in all of these books, there's always a chapter about how the Democrats, you know, their culpability in all the things I'm describing. It was time to actually, you know, sit down and try to figure that out. And what I wound up doing, you know, of course, once you start studying these things, the subject sort of opens up to you. And what I wound up doing was developing a kind of theory of well, what I call it the theory of the liberal class, mm-hmm. but a theory of how the Democratic Party works and why they do the things they do, the sort of self-destructive things that they do.
Yeah, it's kind of an indictment of the meritocracy.
Yeah.
At some,
yes.
Yeah, at some level, that whole notion that the cream will naturally rise.
Yeah, that's it is that. That is right. I'm sort of proud of that. So what I try to do in these books, in this one and also in What's the Matter with Kansas, is talk about broader subjects and but then bring them down to the level of politics. So Listen, Liberal is about, you know, a society that is governed by this kind of professional class and what that means to live in a meritocracy. And this is a class of people that really, you know, professionals, affluent, white-collar, highly educated people, they tend to really believe in the philosophy of in meritocracy as a philosophy, that the people on top are up there because they're the best and everybody gets what they deserve, and what they deserve is defined by how they did in school. And this is, you know, this is a social theory that is wrong in mm-hmm. about 100 ways. But you apply it to politics, you know, and you make it a philosophy of government, man, and it's positively disastrous in my view.
Well, and it's interesting because the book was published in the near the end of the Obama administration.
It was exactly a year ago, almost exactly to the day a year ago.
But it's there are parts of it that are just absolutely prescient here, because what the subtext to it really is. Okay, because the Democrats, in many ways, have abandoned the working class as a natural constituency, this huge group of hardworking and increasingly frustrated Americans, in many ways, are up for grabs right now.
That's exactly right. That's what I was going to say. That is the exact right words. The Democratic Party, when I was growing up, was closely identified with organized labor and with working people and the middle class generally. I mean, and that's they would never shut up about it. I mean, that's Lyndon Johnson. That's who he was. You know, or Hubert Humphrey. That's who these people were. Harry Truman. And, okay, I don't remember Harry Truman. I'm not old enough for that. But.
Well, our lives overlap. You're a little younger than I am.
Yeah. But the Democratic Party today is a very different very different organization, and the main it's still a party that is very interested in the fortunes of a particular social class. It's just not the working class; it's this professional class that I mentioned earlier. This is the group that the Democratic Party cares about the most. Now they have lots of other constituent, you know, other parts of their coalition: women, minorities, the young, a whole bunch of different groups. But among their constituents, the professional class is always who comes first. And this is the group that all of their leaders, almost all of their leaders at the national level, are drawn from. And this is the group they spin these kind of theories about how, you know, professionals, they call them the creative class. You know, you have to reorganize your city in order to please the creative class. You have to write trade deals in order to make the creative class happy. They call them an innovation class. This is the group that they really bow down to, and you see this reflect. And tell me when I should shut up.
No.
But when you listening. So that one of the great mysteries in the book that I tried to answer is why did Barack Obama, who was elected in this sort of crucial moment with the economy in collapse, the financial crisis going on, you know, Wall Street looting the world. Why did he choose to basically let Wall Street off the hook and never punish these guys in any way? You know, when he had the perfect opportunity to do so, why did he choose to go the way that he did? And the answer that I ultimately come to is because of his belief in the Democratic Party generally, their belief in this philosophy of the creative class. They see Wall Street bankers as creative professionals, people that you need to look up to.
Yeah, and you don't, by the way, don't apologize for going on. Right? We sort of
I have a tendency to talk too much, and I apologize.
No, don't apologize. We promote this program as talk radio for people with attention spans. So
okay, then.
So they actually can follow a fairly intricate argument through or thought process. At what point, and I'm leading you because I have read the book, obviously, but what prompted this evolution for the Democratic Party? And I should say that if our listeners want to join the conversation, they can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Because as you point out, you know, Democratic Party, FDR, embraced the whole idea of the Democratic Party being the party of the working man and the party of the at least economically dispossessed. His views on race weren't always enlightened.
Right.
Truman, same thing.
Yeah. A little better on race, though.
Yeah, a little better, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So I only say that because I just the other couple months ago, I took my kids to the Truman Library in Kansas City. And we learned all about that stuff. But so this the big change in the Democratic Party goes back to the early 1970s or the late 60s. And what happened is after the 68 election, which the Democrats lost, Richard Nixon was elected. Donald Trump's hero, by the way, Richard Nixon was elected. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats tried to sit down and figure out what had gone wrong. And they set up a commission to reform the Democratic Party. And that commission decided eventually to remove organized labor from its structural position within the Democratic Party and to instead reach out to this different group of people, the sort of idealistic, enlightened college kids of the time, the sort of proto-professionals, mm-hmm. the kids at fancy colleges who are going to go on to be professionals. And that's who they decided was going to be their new constituent group. And, I think this is a decision that has been very costly for us as a nation. When the party of the left decides to identify with a high prestige and an affluent group, a group of winners, rather than the middle class and the working class, that is a mistake that has cost us dearly over the years. That said, I can totally understand why they did it, why the Democrats made this decision back in the 70s. It was because of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
Unions had supported President Johnson on the Vietnam War, by and large. And these guys at this commission took, they were disgusted by that. And I think rightfully so. And they also, at the time, no one was afraid of inequality. No one thought in their wildest dreams that they would be headed, sending the country back to a sort of 19th century, distribution of wealth, which is what has happened, But that was no one was thinking that in 1971. Instead, they were thinking, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. This was an act of idealism,
yes.
And it has played out very badly. It has played out really poorly, but it that was the beginning of it. But you can trace it all through the 70s, all through the 80s, and it sort of comes to flower with the Bill Clinton presidency when he basically says, I'm a new Democrat. I'm a new kind of Democrat. We're looking for the third way. We are not FDR Democrats anymore. We're not about the New Deal and the working class. And he proceeds to get the famous trade deals done, NAFTA, the China trade deal, and also to deregulate Wall Street, among other things, and to do away with the welfare system. And that is a new kind of Democrat. It's completely different than what went before.
We are talking with author Thomas Frank about many things, most recently, though, his book, Listen Liberal. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. It's great to talk to you again. I just wanted to note and comment that you hit the nail on the head, but considering that we abandoned the base of the Democratic Party when we walked away from the working class and started to look to the professional class as the leadership of the Democratic Party. So there was that was a break with the working class people who basically pushed Donald Trump over the top is the reason why he's elected president now.
There you go. That's exactly
right. But I
want
to take a little simpler approach to it real quickly, if I may.
Yeah, very quickly, because we're getting up on a break.
No problem. Real quickly.
Thanks.
The idea of we, whenever we start talking about we is in the eye of the beholder. So Donald Trump says we, and the people who he knows are all rich. Got lots of money. He's always been around people that way. So when he says we, he's talking about a whole different group of people than when what used to be a Democrat saying we, when he was referring to the middle class, lower class, people who were left behind, people who were dumped. Your comments on that.
Thanks very much for the call.
What can I say? That's exactly right. But the one thing I – and we are often, I think, you know, I'm going to say some harsh things about Donald Trump, but I think we're deceived by his rhetoric, which oftentimes you'd listen to his speeches, and he'd actually sound good on some things. Even from my very liberal point of view, he sounded good on the trade deal, sounded good on Big Pharma. But what the caller said is exactly right. He has a different group of people in mind, and we sort of fell for it, I think. But the other thing, the Democrats, that is exactly right, that the Democrats used to care about the disinherited and, you know, building up the middle class. I mean, oh, my God, that's what they cared about more than anything. And today they really are mainly concerned with a group of winners, the new economy winners.
We are talking with the author Thomas Frank. He is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas and most recently Listen Liberal. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today with the author Thomas Frank. He's in town to speak to the steelworkers this evening. Tom is the author.
Well, it's actually open to the public.
It is too. Okay,
yeah.
So
I think anybody can.
Is there a cost?
I don't know. If there is, it's not going to be a whole lot.
It's a nominal thing.
Yeah, but yeah. The important thing is the book is out in paperback now. It's very affordable. So
you can, and he'll be selling and signing books presumably there as well. We will post all of the information in regard to Tom's appearance at 218 South Addison Street. I believe it's at 7 o'clock tonight.
Yeah.
On our Facebook page. So if you want to check on that, that would be great. Should say he's the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, and most recently Listen Up Liberal. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, welcome to the program. John, welcome to the program.
My big question, kind of going with Listen Liberal still, Bernie Sanders was all about the working class. He was polling better than Hillary against Trump. He was polling with all the independents well, and yet the superdelegates and the DNC all backed Hillary, and it was like I was sitting there thinking, why are you backing the candidate that shows a lower chance than Bernie Sanders? You know, Bernie versus Hillary. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about why the DNC and the superdelegates backed Hillary instead of Bernie.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's easy.
Thanks very much for the call, John.
Yeah, because she's a Democrat. They've known her for decades. She has promised every single one of them something. If Hillary had become president, everyone in Washington would have moved up a click. If Bernie Sanders had become president, you know, nobody in the I mean, everybody, you know, all the people who run the Democratic Party would be out. Mm-hmm. It's like they don't want that. You know, Hillary was obviously their person. But look, I did a I voted for Bernie in the primaries. I was a big fan of Bernie Sanders. He did an amazing thing. I mean, this is a man who 5 years ago was regarded as a fringe character, a marginal figure in Washington, D.C., a sort of a crank. And, you know, you look at what he did, and he won the votes of millions and millions of people. Another thing, I wrote an article for Harper's Magazine. You might have seen it. It was a study of the way the media treated Bernie Sanders. And the way I studied the media was to read every single Washington Post editorial and op-ed about Bernie Sanders from January to June of 2016. I read every single one, and I tallied them up and, you know, did the math. And they were basically against him by a ratio of 5-1. And they really hated this guy. I mean, really strongly disliked Bernie Sanders. And so I was trying to figure out when I was writing this, like, why? Why would any – because he's not a hateable – man, he's kind of a lovable, you know, he's a lovable figure. You know, why do people dislike him so much?
He looks like your unkempt old uncle.
Exactly. You know? He wears a suit. There's no scandals, you know.
Yeah.
He's a really good guy. How can they hate him so much? And I think a lot of it was this sort of and these are journalists, remember, not technically part of the Democratic Party. A lot of it was the same professional class solidarity that I've been described that you see in so many other places. They look at Hillary and they see someone just like them. I'm talking about, by the way, the columnists and editors of the Washington Post. These are the top of the journalism profession. These are people who, by and large, went to very, you know, prestigious schools, people who consider themselves highly professional. They look at Hillary and they see someone just like themselves. They look at Bernie and they see, you know, Huey Long or something. You know, it's unthinkable demagogue, you know.
Well, was it also possible, I mean, tying into your thesis, that you know, there was something going on there that was similar. I'm thinking of actually another writer's book, William Grider's Who Will Tell the People, from 25 years ago.
Yes, where, I actually own that, and I'm trying to remember what it's about. It's about the Federal Reserve, right?
No, I mean, what he makes an argument, actually, that one of the things that's wrong with journalism is that one time reporters were themselves
that's
part
right. I
of the working
now.
Class.
That's right. They consider themselves blue collar.
And that one of the, you know, unintended consequences of sort of the Watergate revolution in the field is that it became a true profession with professional aspirations, and we began to see our sources more as peers than as
exactly.
Sources.
And by the way, and I should mention here that I live in, the place I live is Bethesda, Maryland, and the sort of cream of the journalism world lives in this same suburb. Mm-hmm. Like Tom Friedman lives down the street. David Brooks used to live there. A lot of these people from the very top of the journalism profession. And what fascinates me about this group, the mm-hmm. sort of top people in journalism, is the complete lack of solidarity with average, or sympathy even, with average working class people, and even with their own colleagues at newspapers around America, which are, you know, in a state of collapse these days. Mm-hmm. They ignore that, and they focus on, you know, these high-ranking politicians and diplomats and billionaires and, you know, Wall Street guys who they see as their peers, exactly as you just described.
Got an email from a listener named Bruce, and if you want to join the conversation by email, you can send your thoughts to nolimits@wfyi.org. Bruce writes, I thought this was screamingly obvious. If Obama had raked in the definitely indictable, there would have been national riots over the black Muslim communist who hates America, is the enemy of holy capitalism, etc. The reason was racial.
I wonder about that. I don't think so. I think Obama had a mandate to do exactly what your correspondent Bruce just described. And it's not necessarily that he had to prosecute these guys. I mean, obviously you don't prosecute someone just because the public wants you to. But he was totally within his power, and I think within his rights to fire these people. He did fire the chairman of General Motors. There were no riots when he did that. The time we got closest to riots in this country was, remember the AIG mm-hmm. bonuses? Sort of the opposite, that Obama didn't stop the bonuses going to these people. And the public was like, what the hell is going on, Obama? We just elected you to get tough with these guys. Do you remember that? My opinion, that was the moment where the whole thing broke, where he really lost. You know, the public was totally behind him had he chosen to take decisive action on Wall Street.
We're talking about what's happened to the Democratic Party, really, in some ways, what's happened to the country, with the author Thomas Frank on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Mike has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881.
Hello?
Mike, you there with us?
Yes, I'm here. How are you?
We're doing well. What's on your mind?
Thomas, good. Mr. Frank, honor to talk to you, sir.
Hey, thank you.
I just wanted to comment, though. I disagree that the Democrats have abandoned the working class. I think it's the other way around. And I think it's started when the Fairness Doctrine was eliminated and they started getting conservative talk radio shows that make a more appealing noise to the working class than liberalism does. But to cite my example is, well, number one, when the working class doesn't care about the poor and indigent, you know, the Democrats are there to represent their constituency. What choice do they have? But really, to cite the example is, you know, Trump was all about working people. Well, in 2010 or 11, he made the comment that GM should fail, just let him fail. And the Democrats are the ones that saved GM and Chrysler, and then they turn around and vote for Trump. So, you know, it's like I said, I don't think the Democrats have abandoned the working class. I think it's the other way around.
By the way, that's
thanks
I think,
very much for
well,
the call,
I think
Mike.
That was one of Obama's his best moments was rescuing the auto companies, and working class has also walked away from the Democrats, and the question is, whose fault is it? It's tough to blame millions and millions and millions of people when you can read in Democratic Party documents, magazine articles, and all this sort of thing that their plan to basically walk away from that group beginning in the 1970s. Now that said, what the caller said about talk radio, AM talk radio, that is mm-hmm. that is totally right. I mean, we all know that. You drive around in rural Kansas or mm-hmm. Missouri and that's all there is on the radio. And if you are upset with the world, if you're angry about something, that's the outlet for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that is an amazing thing that has happened. I mean, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that we're in this age of massive discontent. People are very angry about all sorts of things, and that anger always draws them to the right. And the AM talk radio is a big part of it. But what I ultimately have to keep coming back to is that two can play at that game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason that modern liberalism hasn't caught on in that same regard. Mm-hmm. You know, I could imagine a liberal talk show that has the kind of popularity of Rush Limbaugh. I mean, there's been various efforts, but it never catches on. Now, why is that? I mean, I think because the nature of the beast, there's something about modern liberalism is very uncomfortable with discontent.
Mm-hmm.
It's very uncomfortable with economic grievance. It is comfortable with the idea of charity, with helping out the very mm-hmm. poor. They feel good about that. But the idea that there is something wrong with the economic system itself, that unless you regulate it, have unions, do all these different things that we used to do in this country, that unless you do those things, it will grind, it will grind up people's lives. They're not comfortable with that. They don't like that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just throw in another idea?
Yeah, please. No.
So I've studied the conservative movement a lot.
Yeah.
I wrote three books about the conservative movement. And one of the things that you consistently see them doing, the conservatives, that is mimicking left-wing protest movements from long ago.
Yeah.
This is what the Tea Party movement was. Glenn Beck mm-hmm. mimicked Martin Luther King's March on Washington. You know, they do this all the time. And Donald yeah. Trump echoes Franklin Roosevelt. The other day, this blew
yeah.
my mind. The other day, Trump went and laid a wreath at the grave of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah.
The founder of the Democratic Party,
yes,
and the original populist in this country. And that's they totally own the populist style. The conservatives own it because the Democrats are who should be their property. They're the
yeah.
inheritors of Jackson and Bryan and Roosevelt. They can't talk that way anymore.
And I can't really tell with Trump whether that is for those of us who know something about American history, Jackson was also the first president to really shake his fist at the U.S. Supreme Court.
And the banks.
And the banks.
That's the big thing.
And
there.
All of that, whether – and was censured for that.
Yeah.
Was really – I mean, the country at the time thought that the heathens had taken over the sacred temple.
Yeah.
So,
well, they think that again now.
Yeah.
But, Trump likes
–
it's a fanciful comparison. I don't yeah. think it really holds water, but, that is Trump's fantasy.
Yeah. We've gotten a question from a listener named Janet via Facebook, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Janet writes, "Hi, enjoying this conversation, and it leaves me wondering about the answer to this dilemma. Why is it an either-or proposition, support the working class and sacrifice the professional class and vice versa? Aren't we all people who have to work for a living and want better things for the next generation? And aren't many people in the professional creative class just a few paychecks or a market downturn away from tumbling to working poor? So how do we bridge this chasm?"
That is an excellent question. And in my view, of course, this is what the listener says is it seems like a no-brainer. You have to bridge that chasm, and you have to you have to legislate with the fortunes of the working class in mind. And I think if you were to do that, yeah, the professional class would come along. Now, what she said, this is I'm sorry, I'm getting all tongue-tied here, but
that's okay.
Look, this is the critical thing here. people at the bottom of the professional class, and I'm a member of this class. I have a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
When I got out of graduate school in the mid-1990s, big surprise.
You were a Republican in college, too.
No, that was before. This is graduate school.
But in college, you started your life as a Republican.
That was a long time ago.
Okay.
When I got out of graduate school, with my PhD in American history, I discovered that the job market for historians had been completely casualized and that the chances of me becoming a tenured professor of history somewhere were very, very slim. And instead, you had to work as an adjunct. It's a very low-paid job. And this happened to my entire generation of PhDs. We basically got ruined. And you see this with all sorts of different professions. Journalists. Oh, my God. Look what's happened to them. It's happening to the legal profession. There are certain kinds of medical doctors that it's happening to as well. And they're saddled by these enormous loans. You think of the kids just getting out of college now who did as the president told them and went to college and studied hard and did well on the SAT and took out all these loans. They could go to one of these fantastically expensive schools that they're told is the best. And then they're saddled with $100,000 in debt and they're getting out there into the workforce and they're discovering that they're absolutely screwed. Yes, we need to, we should identify with those people. And even though they're nominally members of the professional class, they basically are the new proletariat. But here's the tricky thing. This is what I discovered when I researched the professional class. There's no solidarity in a meritocracy. The people at the top, remember we're talking about those Washington Post reporters or those people in the Treasury Department, those people at Goldman Sachs or whatever, or the people who are tenured professors at Harvard, feel zero solidarity with members of their own profession who are struggling. Because the doctrine of meritocracy, the blame always goes back to them. The blame is always on you for your own, somehow you screwed it up. Anybody that's worked in a white-collar workplace knows what I'm talking about. When someone gets fired, they don't rally around this person. They don't get together and confront the boss or something. It never happens in the white-collar workplace. They always figure he had it coming. It's every man for himself. And that is the toxic nature of this politics. Anyhow, I talk too much. I'm
sorry. No. We've gotten another question via email or Facebook from a listener named Nick. Our Facebook address is NoLimitsWFYI. Nick writes, can you comment on Senator Schumer's recent announcement that Senate Democrats will filibuster Neil Gorsuch's confirmation to the Supreme Court? With the threat of the GOP going nuclear, is this the wrong stand to take?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it's all very predictable. The Republicans will try to peel off some Democratic votes, and if they can't, they will take away the filibuster. This is just day-to-day politics. Trump has already said he wants them to take away the filibuster. One of the things that got me about the Obama era was Obama should have done that a long time ago. The man had this enormous popular mandate, and he should have done away. The filibuster is an inherently undemocratic thing. Obama should have done away with it. But the Democrats, this is, by the way, a kind of instructive issue. The Democrats always want to find consensus. I always want to reach bipartisanship, and the Republicans just don't care about it. They want their way.
One of the things that I found fascinating, too, is this is extended even into the way that we view the past. I mean, sort of the revisionist now histories of the Great Depression and the New Deal, that merging even the attempt to appropriate the term the forgotten man.
Yes. Amity Schlaes.
Amity Schlaes, yes. As a student of history, how damaging is that?
That's what made the Tea Party movement possible. Are you familiar with the novelist Ayn Rand?
Yes.
Okay, so she wrote this novel called Atlas Shrugged, which is the Bible of the right in Washington, D.C., and you see people carrying it around on the subway trains. Anyhow, it's the Great Depression stood on its head. It's a Great Depression in an alternate universe where the Depression, the 30s, is caused by government regulation rather than by the failure.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
It's fascinating, but they believe in an entire alternate theory of the Great Depression. And the reason that's important is that is the founding decade of our modern Democratic Party. That's where it comes from. And they've, in their minds, have completely reversed the whole story.
We are talking with the author Thomas Frank about the state of America right now. He's the author of most recently the book Listen Liberal, but also What's the Matter with Kansas, Pity the Billionaire and the Wrecking Crew. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with the author Thomas Frank. He is the author of most recently Listen Liberal, but also What's the Matter with Kansas, The Wrecking Crew, and Pity the Billionaire. He is in town to speak tonight at the Steelworkers Local 1999 at 218 South Addison Street here in Indianapolis. The program will run from 6:30 till 9 this evening, and it's free of charge.
Yeah. And there's going to be beer.
And there's going to be
beer. You'll probably have to pay for it, but it's going to be there.
And, yeah, the beer you'll have to pay for.
Yeah, so it's going to be fun, man. It's like a baseball game. It's but yeah, 6:30. I was wrong when I said it was 7. It's actually at 6:30.
We are talking with Thomas about the state of the United States right now. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named George has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. George, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. So I find this argument fairly reductionistic and oversimplified and kind of absurd. Elections are won on margins. There were lots of working people represented in this election. A lot of them were called Hispanic. A lot of them were called women. Both my wife and daughter went to the Women's March. I grew up in the Democratic Party that he's talking about, working class in southern Indiana. And I would say that racism and sexism are really continue to be rampant, and that is the home. So the bottom line that working people have been abandoned by the Democratic Party, I find is sort of reductionistic. And I think the writer fails to maybe recognize, or maybe
That's
doesn't,
me.
But fail to recognize the element zeitgeist, which is called racism, sexism, and misogyny. And so since elections are won on margins, I think there were a significant percentage of folks who were not going to vote, not because of the elitism of the Democratic Party, but because they were never going to vote.
Thanks very much for the call and the comments, George.
So my view is that this was the elections, obviously there's a lot of different, as the caller pointed out, there's a lot of different, lines in society that where people are divided. But class is one of the most significant ones, and it was the one that really determined this election. Hillary actually did poorly on a class basis across the board. We know about white working class voters in places like Indiana, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. What is getting a lot less coverage is that a lot of black working class voters who remain by and large loyal Democrats simply didn't turn out for her this time. They were not enthusiastic about this race. And it was a class turned out to be the determining factor this time around.
But to pick up on George's point, I know here in Indiana, the politics obviously I'm most familiar with, when there have been female candidates who are aspiring to an office that we in the executive branch, what some another political writer refers to as the father figure office.
There's absolutely no question in my mind about that. That misogyny is out there, and that was probably an important factor in this. Can I just say one other thing?
Let me jump in, though, and ask a hypothetical on your last point, though. I mean, would we have been having this same kind of discussion, say, if Elizabeth Warren had run? I think you have to assume that she would have been able – she would have been more appealing to Bernie Sanders voters than Hillary Clinton was.
I think that's exactly right. I think Elizabeth Warren would have done considerably better than Hillary Clinton – and the reason Hillary ran a very class specific campaign, she ran as a resume candidate, emphasizing her expertise. Her slogan was America is already great, or one of her semi-official slogans, America is already great. It's utter complacency. Mm-hmm. Her big aim was to do well with affluent Republicans in the suburbs. And she did well, of course, with them and in wealthy college towns, and basically got wiped out everywhere else. And, you know, that's not a recipe for success. Now, Elizabeth, and the other thing about Hillary, you got to remember, she was totally vulnerable to Trump's, you know, Trump's, what would you call it, use of the trade issue. Trade was, in my mind, the number one issue in this campaign. Democrats don't like to talk about it. They don't like to acknowledge it. It's in some ways their guilty conscience because they remember what they did with NAFTA, how they steamrolled over their former allies in organized labor. And Hillary Clinton is forever tarred with that label because of her last name. And also because as Secretary of State, she had a hand in you know, negotiating new trade deals. Someone like Elizabeth Warren would obviously not have been vulnerable on that issue. And by the way, neither would Bernie Sanders, neither would Joe Biden, neither would Martin O'Malley. None of the leading the other – in some ways, Hillary was the only one who was vulnerable on that issue and you know, the only one who could have possibly lost to Trump.
We are talking with the author – Thomas Frank, about the state of America here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Kim has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Quickly, I'm wondering two things. One, there are political scientists, historians out there who are saying that they believe our democracy truly is in jeopardy under a Trump administration, and I'm wondering what your guest thinks about that. And then secondly, whether or not, you know, the thesis is right, what do we do now? What do Democrats do now? What's the next step for Democrats in the current system? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call.
You know, the I was really alarmed and frightened when Trump first became president for two reasons. One, because he's utterly incompetent on foreign policy. And I was afraid he would get us into a war or something. And but he's now appointed people to run, you know, the State Department and the Pentagon who seem to know what they're doing. So I'm not as worried. I mean, they're going to make bad policy. I have no doubt. His advisors are some of the worst, you know, I'm sorry to say this, some of the worst people I've ever seen in high office. You know, the thing is when Democrats talk about him as, you know, would be dictator and all this sort of thing. Being a dictator implies competence. This guy doesn't have that. You know, he hasn't even got a single piece of – has he got any legislation passed yet? You know, this is like – so far I have seen nothing out there that would indicate that he's – you know, he talks big and he blusters and he threatens people and he says mean things on Twitter all the time. And he's – you know, I can't stand the guy. Mm-hmm. But he may want to be a dictator, but he doesn't know how. You know, I've been reading this book about Huey Long.
Yeah.
You know, the great biography of Huey Long that came out in the late 70s, won the Pulitzer Prize.
The Harry Williams, right?
Yeah.
T. Harry
and
Williams,
the stuff this guy got done is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, Trump is not even in the same ballpark as that guy.
Yeah, well, and you got to figure make an argument that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the master politician of the 20th century.
Oh, my God. Yeah, no,
and the fact that Roosevelt was scared along should tell you something about
it. That's right.
We've gotten an email from our regular listener, Jerry. And if you want to join the conversation, as Jerry does, via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, I'm a socialist in the tradition of fellow Hoosier Eugene V. Debs.
Hey.
Does today's guest agree that for the left to become relevant again, it somehow must convince ordinary Americans that the feasibility of a just, stable, and prosperous civilization is absolute fantasy without a substantial and strong federal government?
Possibly. It's funny that he calls himself a socialist. I just came back from Scandinavia, you know, which famously these are social democracies. And people in America often think of Scandinavia. It's like totalitarianism or something. And I'm here to tell you it's not. It's like the path that we were on in America back in the you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then we turned away from that path. But you know, you go over there, and the streets are clean, the buildings are beautiful, people all have health care, health insurance, you know, the water is clean, and it's like they continued on down the road that we did not travel, and they call it social democracy. Here in America, we would call it something else. You know, the middle class society or something like that. It doesn't really matter what label you apply to it. But that looks pretty good to me these days. You know, the a sort of comprehensive welfare state, That looks pretty good to me these days. And yeah, I think you would have to have a fairly powerful federal government for that. Look, Americans are very they don't seem to have any problem with a very powerful federal government on the military side of things. Anyhow, yeah, I look forward to the day that we achieve that. Unfortunately, we're going in the wrong direction as fast as our legs will carry us.
We've gotten a question, actually a couple of questions, from a listener named Michael via Facebook. And if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Michael wants me to ask you to comment about the infighting in the recent election of the new DNC chair, and also, do you mean that white working people are starting to drift from the Democrats? Start with that first point first. I mean, that is one of the interesting developments that people actually cared about who the DNC chair was.
I mean, it's the larger question, which I think is more important, which is, what do you do about everything that we've just described? What can we do about it? And one of the things that I've realized in the course of all my writing about our political system is that the two-party system is basically locked in this country. It is protected by law.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that makes the Democrats behave the way they do is that they are fully aware that there's no possibility of a new party rising up to challenge them from the left or from anywhere else. It's impossible. The only challenge they're ever going to face is with the Republican Party. And so if you want to reform the Democrats, the battle has to be within the party. And I think Bernie Sanders understood that. You know, he didn't do what Ralph Nader did. He didn't do what Ross Perot did. He ran as a Democrat, and he challenged Hillary Clinton from within the Democratic Party, and he lost. But
he did move her to the left, though.
He moved her to the left, and he won millions of votes, far more votes than anybody thought possible. But now that, you know, I think a lot of people in America can see the point that I tried to – the book is called Listen Liberal for a reason, right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I wanted them to hear this.
Yeah.
And a lot of people now understand this, and they can see that this is plainly true. I mean, the election of 2016 has made this completely clear, that the white working class has moved or is in the course of moving to the Republican Party. And the Republicans aren't going to, you know, just give up on that. They're going to keep that going as best as they can. Democrats have to figure out a way to deal with that. The way to deal with that is not Clintonism.
Mm-hmm.
OK, it's not this embrace of the professional class and, you know, building bike paths for the creatives and that sort of thing. These spinning these fantasies about innovation, doing favors for Wall Street and Big Pharma and Silicon Valley. That's not how you beat Trumpism. OK, so the Democratic Party clearly has to change direction. However, the people in charge of the party don't want to do that. They are very comfortable with the Democratic Party the way it is, and they don't want to change. And there's going to have to be a fight within the Democratic Party. Now, this is not widely covered in the media, but this fight is going on right now in D.C. I mean, at all these different levels, the sort of Bernie faction versus the Clinton faction.
Well, in some ways, I guess that's where I was going, because for most of my career, being DNC chair was more a matter of who got the short straw.
It was not a coveted position until now.
But
the Bernie people are very upset about it because they feel like they were cheated in the primaries, and they were to a certain degree. I mean, I think it's Hillary won fair and square in the primaries, but the DNC did cheat. I mean, both things are true, and so they're a little tipped off about that, and I think understandably so. And so they took that election very seriously for the first time that I can remember, and they lost. I mean, the Clintons came down, but it was very close.
It was.
And that was only the first battle. We're going to see a lot of fights like that.
We are talking with the author Thomas Frank about the state of America here on No Limits. Paul, welcome to the program.
John, and really enjoy your program always.
Thank you.
And, sir, I look forward to buying your book. Do you believe that there is a dumbing down of Americans academically? And, you know, it's been said that Donald Trump is a very smart man because his followers are not. Like, the blue states are primarily on the two coasts, the Pacific West, California, Oregon, Washington, obviously, Nevada, and then New England, Boston, New York, and Chicago. Did the unions kill themselves, or was it someone like Ronald Reagan with PATCO as a deep, deep slide? Because, you know, you're looking at FDR, Harry Truman, Adlai Stevenson, who, by the way, I sat on my father's lap and watched the first 1956 televised Stevenson election while he was smoking his Chesterfields, my dad, Jack Kennedy, LBJ, Hubert, George, Jimmy, Dukakis, Clinton, Gore, Barack, and now Hillary. So being based as a Ball State guy growing up in Northwest Indianapolis, I remember all the Republicans. But then when I moved to Muncie, I remember BorgWarner Corporation and a labor union strife where all the union workers were on strike with making automotive parts in Muncie, which was heavily industrial, almost like Northwest Indiana, like East Chicago, Gary Steele, Hammond, all of that, Merrillville. But I'm just wondering about Reagan and Patco and a dumbing down academically
Paul.
America.
I'm gonna let Thomas. We're getting close on time, so thanks.
The part about dumbing down, I'm gonna have to refer you to an essay that I wrote called "Academy Fight Song," and it's my entire critique of American higher ed, and it's a lot of fun to read, and it's on the internet, and you got to read "Listen Liberal." Okay, it's out in paperback now. So, but about unions. You know, yes, unions are obviously in decline in America. Now, this is not because people are consumer choice or something like that. People would like to, by and large, think having a union is a good idea or having some way to bargain with their boss is a good idea. The problem is that if you try to form a union in the United States in a workplace, you're going to get fired. And everyone knows this now. And so union organizing is at a kind of all-time low. If you go on strike, you're going to get replaced. Strikes are at an all-time low. Union power is very weak. Now, this is not because the idea of collective bargaining is a bad idea or it's an unpopular idea. It's because the law is written in such a way in America as to permit the kind of things I just described. Unions go to the Democrats every couple of years after they work their butts off to get somebody like Barack Obama elected or Bill Clinton, and they say, Jimmy Carter, and they say, here's our one issue. And it's always some variation on make it easier to form unions, make it possible to form unions again in America. Yeah. And the Democratic politicians of our day and age, by and large, don't care. I mean, Barack Obama, there was this very famous moment early on in his presidency when the union said, we want to get this bill passed. It was called Card Check. We don't need to go into the details now. But it would have changed the economic landscape of this country. It would have reversed inequality. Every Starbucks in America would be unionized now, that kind of thing. And Obama was like, see you later, guys. And look, had he backed them on that and had he got that thing passed, he probably would have never – I mean, we would be in a very different situation today. I mean, the Trumpism would never have happened. You know, all sorts of things would be completely different. But look, this is happening to America largely because the party of the left in this country, which is traditionally the defender of labor and middle-class people, is no longer interested in that job.
That, I'm afraid, is probably going to have to be the last word because we're at the end of our time, and I want to – apologize to the listeners whose questions we weren't able to get to. I hope, Tom, that you'll come back another time and talk.
Of course. I love doing shows like this.
Well, and we love having you here. Like to thank my guest, Thomas Frank, the author of Listen Liberal, for a provocative conversation. If you want to hear more from him, you can go to Steelworkers Local 1999 at 218 South Addison at 6:30 this evening. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.